This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 225.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we empower you to conquer the marathon. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we talk running and addiction with Dr. Rachel Tambling, licensed therapist and lecturer for the Roadrunners Club of America. And in the quick tips segment, Angie answers a listener question about whether or not to redo a final long run before race day. And to get more awesome content, resources, training plans, coaching, and guidance, you can learn about Academy membership when you visit marathontrainingacademy.com. So, Angie, what's new in the running world? I guess there's probably a lot, but any interesting news tidbits that caught your eye recently?
Yes, actually, one thing that happened recently was chaos at the Mexico City Marathon. Now, we all know about the earthquakes that have been happening down there, which is really, really a tragedy. But yeah. Apparently, at the most recent edition of the marathon, a huge number of the participants were disqualified. 20.6% of the runners, wow, which equals out to about 5,800 people, were disqualified for skipping timing mats or doing them out of order. And apparently this has been happening for years, but the race is only now cracking down on many runners who will just do portions of the race as part of like a long run, or will just jump in. And, you know, a lot of them want a finish line photo or a medal for social media purposes. And they think that this medal series that the Mexico City Marathon has been doing for the last 5 years is contributing. So each year the medal is like a letter and it'll eventually spell out Mexico.
Oh, nice.
So they're really cool. And then next year is the final one, the O. Uh-huh. So they're thinking that it's going to be really bad again next year. But, you know, it's this whole controversy really kind of brings down the spirit of marathoning and running in general. So, you know, it's kind of been something that has kind of shaken up the running world a bit.
Definitely something that happens here at U.S. races, too. Maybe not, you know, quite a large percentage that we know of. But, yeah, definitely every year people cheat at the Boston Marathon, for example.
Right, right.
We actually did a whole episode about race day cheaters a couple of years ago. After Angie ran her Georgia Marathon, what was that, the Chickamauga Georgia Marathon? Did I say that right?
Yes.
The woman that won it that year was later disqualified because
for cutting the course, yeah, and cheating.
Her splits were unrealistic. Like, she would have had to run sub 1 hour half marathon or something crazy.
Yeah, it was really bizarre. And unfortunately, this kind of thing does happen. I would say that runners are not immune from bad behavior, which also reminds me of another headline that people have probably seen about the mad pooper in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Some people right now are scratching their heads. They're like, what did she just say?
That's right, folks. Mad pooper. So apparently there is this runner.
That should be on a t-shirt.
I'm sure there will be, probably. So there's this female runner in Colorado Springs who has been routinely for the past 7 weeks taking dumps on people's lawns in this neighborhood in full view of people, children, in fact. And, you know, they've asked her to stop multiple times, taken pictures of her to try to identify her. You know, police are now seeking her to probably charge her with, I don't know, what you can, you know, public display of nudity or
indecent exposure.
So it's just really, really bizarre, you know, because there's public bathrooms nearby. So it just seems very strange.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, if you've been running long enough, we've all unfortunately had that sensation like, I've got to go now. This could be a disaster kind of thing.
Right.
But never once have I considered pooping on someone's lawn. You know, I mean, there's always been another alternative. So bizarre stuff. Hopefully the mad pooper is not a listener to this podcast, but if she is,
please
rethink your behavior quickly.
I just like to say that she does not represent the running community as a whole.
I know. That's the bizarre thing, is these kind of stories get major headlines, and then it brings a stink to the running community, to say the least.
Nice pun. Hey, did you see that video? Someone just posted this lady who I guess was cramping up so bad that she had to basically army crawl and then roll, like barrel roll across the finish line of her marathon in order to qualify for Boston, but she made it. Did you see that video?
I did. That was really, really amazing. I mean, such determination.
Yeah. So just maybe that's a good one to end on here for our news segment.
That's right. There is good out there. There's people who are focused on doing the right thing. And if you have to turn the last part of your marathon into an obstacle race to get it done, I guess, you know, do what you have to do.
Never let cramping have the final word, right?
Yeah.
Well, we'll post that video if I can find a way to do it on our website with show notes to this episode. It's pretty cool. People are cheering her on. She's rolling across the finish line. I mean, that had to be some pretty serious cramping going on right there.
Ooh, yeah. Anyone who's ever cramped badly will have sympathy.
Well, we always like to give shout-outs to people doing awesome things. And Angie, what do you have for us this time?
Yes, we'd like to say congratulations to Melissa, and she posted this in our Academy group. She says, I ran my first full 26.2 yesterday in my hometown of Erie, Pennsylvania, after following an MTA training plan since May. I stayed right on pace and finished with a time of 4:13.
Nice.
I couldn't be happier and can't wait to put that sticker on my car. Thanks, Angie and Trevor, for your great training plan and inspiring and entertaining podcasts.
We know what sticker you're talking about. We have a 26.2 sticker on our car as well.
That's right.
Actually, Angie has a 50-mile sticker on her car, which I sometimes drive and I pretend that that I've done it too. Well, congrats, Melissa, on running your first marathon, and welcome to the family.
And this one comes from Kristen in the Academy. She says, thank you to MTA for telling me I do have what it takes. Today was my fifth half marathon this summer. I had hated and avoided running my whole 46 years of life and started running about a year ago because age and gravity were catching up with me. Shortly after I started running, I found your podcast as I needed serious help getting started. I never ever thought I would even run a mile, and now I've run hundreds. Thank you for all the encouraging words. I will for sure be listening to your podcast as I run my first marathon, the Twin Cities Marathon, soon.
Great story. And, you know, you just never know the things that you can learn to like that you once didn't like at all. I mean, I can very much identify with what Kristen said. There was, you know, before we started the MTA podcast, not too long before that, I was pretty much a non-runner. So I love hearing about people that are building up from basically, you know, walking to now going to train for her first marathon.
This next note comes from Ida in the Academy. She says, I had a race to remember in Copenhagen yesterday. The race got shut down, but everyone I was running with finished and got a medal, despite absolute mayhem at the finish line. I ran through thunder, lightning, hailstones, torrential rain, and sunshine all in one race. The course got completely flooded, and the last kilometer I ran through huge sections of calf-deep, icy water. So I couldn't quite reach my A goal, but I managed a personal best by some 30 seconds. More importantly, I felt great during the race, and I certainly won't forget this one.
And they were pulling people off the course there, weren't they?
Yes. We also had another Academy member, Ann Sophie, who finished this race in just under 2 hours and 1:59 before it was shut down. And the story is that this popular Copenhagen half marathon featured more than 20,000 runners, and it started off under clear skies, so blue skies.
Yep.
But things quickly took a turn for the worst, and they had severe lightning, rain, hail, even snow that fell on the Danish capital. And flooding at the finish line was so bad that timing mats began to float away. And pretty much everyone after the two-hour mark were probably affected. And in fact, a runner, a photographer, and a race volunteer were hit by lightning and had to be hospitalized.
Oh, man.
So it was some pretty brutal conditions. So we're really thankful that Ann Sophie and Ida were able to finish and were safe, most importantly.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm sure this will be a race they will never forget.
Definitely.
And this last note is from Kyle, and he says, I just finished my first marathon and wanted to say thanks. I found your podcast about 2 months ago and gained a lot of knowledge and encouragement to help me get through. I had what it takes to run a marathon and changed my life.
Well, great to hear from another first-time marathoner and just have it echoed back. You know how it was a life-changing experience. We've definitely seen that to be true over and over again. So thank you so much for that note, Kyle. Congrats to everyone out there building up your miles and your endurance and learning new things about yourself along the way. We're so glad to be on this running journey with you. We want you to do it smart and to do it safe. So we're going to talk about running and addiction, something that we've never covered on the podcast before. But we have a great guest. Angie, maybe you can tell the folks a little bit about the guest that we have and kind of what led to this interview.
Well, I was working on my Level 2 Roadrunners Club of America coaching certification this summer.
Yes, RRCA, which is like one of the main coaching certifications for running coaches here in the States.
That's right. And so I had an in-person weekend course that I went to, and then there were several online modules. And I listened to the one by Dr. Rachel Tambling about understanding running and addiction. And it was just so good. I mean, she's extremely well-spoken, really knows her stuff. And, you know, it's really a topic that I have not heard a lot about in the running community, and something we've never really delved into in depth on the podcast before. So I thought that this would be a really helpful topic, because I know there's people out there who are probably dealing with some kind of running or exercise addiction, or have dealt with one in the past, or, you know, even one of the eating disorders that we're going to talk about. So it's weighty material, but I think it's something that's a really needful topic to get out there.
All right, so let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Rachel Tambling right now. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. Now that I'm well on my way, well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. All right, we're on the podcast now with Rachel Tambling, who is joining us via Skype. Rachel, great to have you on the MTA podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. I'm a longtime subscriber, so this is really
awesome.
Exciting.
Awesome. Well, Rachel, I have to tell you that I was finishing up my Level 2 coaching course mm-hmm. for Roadrunners Club of America, and I did your course on understanding running and addiction, and it was amazing. And I thought, this is something that I don't hear talked about enough. I need to get this lady on the podcast. So we're very happy to have you here today with us. And for our listeners, give us a background on your education and also how you got started in long distance running.
Sure. Well, I'll start with long distance running, because that was actually sooner. I got started in long distance running as a soccer player, actually. I played soccer my whole life and always ran just because I enjoyed it. It was something that I enjoyed about the training, and I enjoy the process of running. I'm one of those process people that I don't need to be training for anything in particular. I just enjoy running. I like running when I travel for work in new cities. I like running and noticing all the different things about the area that I live in. So I really fell in love with running in college. Then I blew out my knee playing soccer and woke up from the surgery asking if I could run. I didn't ask if I could play soccer. I didn't care about that. What really mattered to me was, would I be able to run again? And would I be able to run at the level that I had been running? And that was really surprising to me. And so I've been completely dedicated to running since then. And so a little about my background. I am a professor at University of Connecticut. I am the director of our master's and PhD programs in marriage and family therapy, which are counseling programs. My background is in trauma survivorship and addiction work. So I am a licensed therapist. I work a lot with athletes of all levels on things that can impact performance, but aren't necessarily performance anxiety. So we know a lot of athletes work with coaches and other people around performance anxiety. I tend to work with athletes who are struggling with addiction or trauma recovery or something like that that's impacting their performance in negative ways, both for people at high level and at lower levels. But I'm really a specialist in trauma recovery. So that's something that RRCA approached me about, my expertise in trauma, and understanding that for a lot of people who struggle with exercise addiction or with some of the negative aspects of exercise, that comes from either a background of addiction or a background in trauma, or for most of us, even just a really stressful period in our life where we turn to various things to cope. And so that's how I got started with developing that module for RRCA and their training.
Excellent. You know, and let's delve into the issue of addiction here, because in the running community, it's not uncommon that you hear someone comment about being addicted to running. And
yes,
it's often kind of bandied about, you know, as a funny thing. Let's talk about what is a positive addiction to start out with.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you said it like that too, because I think this is something as a society that we play with. And I hope if people take away maybe one thing, it's that we need to be more mindful about our language and the way that we use language around things like this. So I hear it kind of bantered about like, oh, I'm addicted to running, or I'm addicted to this, or I'm addicted to that. Most of us aren't. Most of us just enjoy running, and it's a really positive addition to our lives. And that's really important to make that distinction, that it's perfectly healthy to enjoy running. to prefer running as a coping mechanism, to have a bad day and want to go out for a run, and to find running to be a central part of one's life. All of those things are really normal. Where we get concerned is when exercise or running, you know, either or, becomes the most important thing in one's life, and it becomes the number one go-to mechanism for stress reduction or mood management when nothing else will help. So we get really concerned about someone who would identify exercise as the most important thing in their life, or who starts to experience conflict with family and friends around the amount or type of exercise that you're engaging in. Someone who uses exercise as the only way to change their mood. So we'd be looking at someone who you have a bad day and you need the run. There's nothing else that will help. There's nothing else that you can think of that will improve your day other than going for the run. We also would look at someone who feels preoccupied with running and who experiences a sense of loss or irritability if they're unable to engage in exercise. Right. And then the real marker, which is one that we borrow from all types of addiction, which is if you have to, either through injury or through choice, cut down on the amount of running you do and feel terrible and feel that compulsion to restart and develop that preoccupation. So being unable to cut back, unable to take a rest day, because it becomes an issue of dependency. That's what we're really looking at and talking about when we talk about a true exercise addiction, is it becomes dependency, not enjoyment. And that to me is the huge marker. So a lot of us play with this language around, I'm addicted to it. You're not addicted to it if you still really, really love it. You're addicted to it if you need it and have become dependent upon it.
And so maybe you're at a point in your life where it is not healthy for you because of injury, overtraining, whatever, and you still have to do it even though you know it's hurting you.
Exactly. That's what we're looking at. So Okay. It really is an addiction when it's hurting you physically, emotionally, in your family relationships, something like that, but you can't stop because you've become dependent. And there are, I think, a lot of people, more than we talk about, who fall into that category. And so I always encourage people who are concerned about family or friends or even themselves to substitute something else, to substitute wine or substitute cigarettes. If you needed wine as much as you need running, would we be concerned about it?
Right.
And if the answer is yes, then we probably should be concerned. But what happens in our culture, we have such a culture of overuse generally that we tend to be really insensitive to signs of addiction. You know, if you think right now, just alcohol, for example, everyone can name at least one friend who they think drinks a little too much. And I think most runners could name at least one friend who they think runs a little too much, beyond the point when it's healthy.
Yeah. So there's kind of like a 6-factor level of addiction that you talked about in the course that I went through.
Yes.
You know, maybe kind of touch on that so people can see that, you know, it's like not like all or nothing necessarily.
Right. It's absolutely not all or nothing. And so there's a great test that you can give yourself, which includes some of the factors that I just talked about. So the 6 assessment factors are: 1, is exercise the most important thing in your life? Yes or no. 2, conflicts have arisen between me and my family or friends or my partner about the amount or type of exercise that I do. 3, I use exercise as a way of changing my mood. 4, over time, I've increased the amount of exercise I do in one day. Side note to this, if you're training for something, probably that's true for all of us, but this means you had to increase it over time because you almost developed a
kind of resistance to the
right,
previous
yes,
level.
Right, yes, a resistance. Mm-hmm. There you go, to the previous level.
Okay.
5, if I have to miss a run or an exercise session, I feel moody and irritable. And 6, if I cut down and then start again, I always end up exercising as often and as much as before.
So I find myself nodding my head to, you know, a couple of these.
Exactly. And most of us should, right?
Right.
The thing is does it become an issue of dependency? And that's really the true marker, and something that most people who are healthy and have a healthy relationship with running can say no. Some of the signs or symptoms would be, we're looking at a runner who typically sees the exercises outside of training as not beneficial or important. So when running is the only thing that can provide this feeling of comfort, so these people who are addicted to running typically don't engage in yoga or stretching or cross training, for example, because it doesn't give them the same high. Right. So there's that lack of balance among training variables. There's generally little recovery time, generally little cross training, generally very few of what I call the ancillary activities that you know that we all know that we need to do, right? Like foam rolling.
Yeah.
Right. And this really habitual use of exercise to manage emotions or to manage day-to-day experiences. And then we would also look at someone who feels defensive or angry or starts to avoid people who would question that the relationship might not be healthy. So if I said to you, you know, maybe you want to take a look at that, and you were able to engage in a conversation with me around it, I would be a lot less worried about you.
Right.
Does that
right.
make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So that's what we're looking at is this, that it's just gone too far.
Okay. I'm thinking of a wedding rehearsal that I was at one time, mm-hmm. and a lady who missed the rehearsal, and it was her daughter getting married, but she missed it because she had to get the run in, and she just expected yeah. everyone to understand.
I would be concerned about that behavior, right? Because that's the type of thing where yeah. we really have to question, why do you need it that much, right?
Exactly.
And I would also be concerned about that level of inflexibility. So a one-time thing, maybe it's just a poor decision, but I'd be wondering what the pattern is behind that. Is this someone who has missed other family activities because they needed to get the run in? You know, is this someone who goes to running in an effort to manage daily life? And so I think that's where we'd be really concerned. And we'd be really concerned if she wasn't open to a conversation about it, right? Because that's the type of thing that we should be able to talk about. This is another classic one where you could substitute alcohol. If she missed the rehearsal dinner because she was drunk in a bar somewhere, would we be concerned?
Totally.
Absolutely. Just because it's healthy for you doesn't mean you're using it in a healthy way.
So is there a difference between like a disordered exerciser versus addiction?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Disordered exercise is the catch-all term that we use for people who probably maybe should take a look at that, but it hasn't reached the point where it's really bad and really unhealthy. It's a catch-all term, sort of like disordered eating mm-hmm. or a disordered relationship with food. It becomes a catch-all term for things that we're doing that just aren't healthy for us, but that don't fall necessarily into a particular category. And I think it's hugely common. There have been very few studies on this, but I think what we're looking at in terms of probability studies, looking at collegiate athletes, it's about 10% of collegiate athletes experience exercise addiction. And the risk for runners, someone did a probability study of runners who had previously run marathons, and they found the risk to be about 22%, which is really high. It puts it on par with alcoholism and other types of addiction.
So yeah, I was wondering kind of like about the demographics. How does that carry on into, you know, farther into adult life? And is there, I mean, a difference between men and women mm-hmm. in this category?
This is something where there's not a lot of research about it. Most experts agree that the prevalence is probably the same as any other addictive behavior, which puts it in the 10 to 20% category lifetime prevalence. We just know more about competitive runners and collegiate athletes because they're easier to study. They're a much smaller group, and so it's easy to study them and to understand that. And we can make comparisons between competitive and non-competitive runners because it's easy groups to research and capture. And we actually have a great deal of data on really competitive runners, thanks to some of the measures that have been instituted in terms of anti-doping and other things. So we actually know a lot about the behavior of really competitive runners, which makes it easy to research and understand.
It's just hard to track people over their lifetime because they get out of that
yes.
setting. It sounds like kind of a real gap in the research that...
It really is. It really is. And this is hard to track too, because it's a positive thing. Running, staying fit, engaging in exercise, this is a positive and healthy thing. And so it's really extremely difficult to track because people don't think of it as an addiction. They don't think of it in the same way.
Yeah, when you're faced with things like drug or alcohol addiction or even
right.
obesity, it seems like, oh, staying fit, that's, you know, going to be a solution to the problem.
Yes. And they're public health outcomes for other types of addiction. So there's a huge public health outcome for using meth. There's a huge public health outcome for our rates of obesity. you're probably not going to do that bad if you're addicted to exercise. It might mess up your family life. It might mess up your work relationships. It might mess up your relationship with your partner, and it's probably not healthy. But you're not going to end up, for the most part, in the emergency room with an overdose of exercise.
Right.
If that makes sense. So it's extremely difficult to track.
Definitely.
I mean, overtraining could be a risk for sure.
Yes, yes. And if you ask if you ask physical therapists and orthopedic doctors and talk to them about this, they'll say that the prevalence rate is very high because that's what they see in their office. But that doesn't escalate it to the level of public health concern.
Right. And people probably are more comfortable getting help for the physical side effects of it rather than the mental health
yes.
side effects of it.
Exactly. And everyone knows someone who, every runner, I swear, knows someone who is continually injured, who doesn't take the time off that they need to do, who doesn't do the physical therapy they need to do, who doesn't do the ancillary activities they need to do, and jumps right back into running. They don't do the slow acceleration of their training. They jump right back in. They get injured again. And I think a lot of other people would agree with me on this, that part of that cycle of injury comes from addiction and being unable, literally unable, to stop exercising at the level that you once were.
So if you routinely have trouble following, you know, your healthcare provider's recommendations when it comes to your activity level, your running, et cetera. You know, if you're always going to do your own thing, that could be a big sign that this is an issue.
Right. And you just might want to take a closer look at that
and really
think about it and spend the time thinking about, is this the healthiest way to be in my life?
Okay. So if someone is hearing this and maybe they can identify with it, what should they do?
I think the first thing they should do is talk to someone that they trust. You know, whether that's your partner or maybe a training buddy, another runner even, someone that you know, and say, hey, I'm concerned, right? That's the first step to seeking help, is just to say, hey, I'm worried about myself. You know, mom or dad or partner or friend or someone, have you ever noticed anything that you're concerned about? You know, do you worry about me? Do you think about me? Those are great questions to ask just to start to open the conversation. It's really important to have open conversations about this and to seek that support. So there's probably a high percentage of people who can resolve overtraining or disordered exercising on their own and can talk to training partners about helping them to back off. They can start to include other activities in their training. But I would recommend seeking the help of a mental health professional. So there are lots of great ways to find mental health professionals. The major organizations for mental health professionals have online locators for therapists. So you can go to the American Counseling Association, the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, or the National Association for Social Workers. Go to their website. You can look up therapists by specialty, by region, by insurance they take, and find a therapist who is right for you. And if you find that it's causing problems with your family relationships, that's the great time to consider couple or family therapy. And I'm probably a little biased in this, but the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy has a great therapist locator for therapists who can help with couple or family therapy so that you can receive the support that you need. I think it's true, like any other addiction, that having the support of family members or people close to you makes a real difference in your recovery. So I always encourage couple and family therapy in cases of addiction, so you really have that support to get through this in a long-term basis. So I may be biased, but I highly recommend counseling, if not to deal with the addiction directly, but to deal with the things that led to it, to deal with the stress and the other things that tend to be highly associated with addiction.
You know, I'm kind of wondering if our online messaging sometimes too can kind of lead people or feed into running addictions, because, you know, there's always somebody who's running more miles, or they're taking on this huge challenge, or they're doing this and that. And it's easy to look at that and think, well, I'm not doing that much. You know, I'm not running 100 miles a week. So,
right. And it's that way with anything else. You know, it's hard as a problem drinker to get away from social situations that have alcohol. And so this is maybe one of the issues that I'm really passionate about, but I think that we all have an obligation as runners to create a healthy exercise environment for ourselves and for everyone around us. And so for me, I think of a few things when I think about a healthy exercise environment. The first one of those is to focus on the social aspects of running. I know it's great. Most of us are training for something at any given time. It's great to train for something. It's great to have goals. But there have to be phases in everyone's exercise calendar where they focus on the social aspects of running, even within the context of training. Everyone has some miles that they don't need to run a workout in. Focus on the social aspects of running. Be willing to run with someone who's a little slower than you, or to mentor a new runner, or to go to a pub run, or a run from someone's house, or something that enhances the social aspect of running. And if you're an event organizer, hold events that combine exercise with social or recreational things. So I think that runs that end in brunch are a great idea. Runs that go from someone's house are a great idea. All of these things enhance the social aspect, which many of us get out of running, without putting the emphasis on running. I think it's also important to consider spending time with your running buddies outside of an exercise environment or in a cross-training environment.
Right.
Get your running group together to go to yoga. Get your running group together to go to a weightlifting session. My running friends and I recently went to a trampoline park together. Right? It was a great workout, I tell you.
Yes.
So choose activities for your cross-training that you can involve your running partners in, so it de-emphasizes the importance of running in your life.
So it's kind of taking running away from isolation into social environment and more balance, maybe.
And have a more positive relationship with exercise as well. I also really think it's important, and we all have an obligation to do this, is to really monitor our language and how we talk about addiction, and not to make it a joke, because there is someone in your running group, I will almost guarantee it, who is struggling. And so take any comments about anxiety or depression very seriously, and monitor your language use in the way that you choose to talk about running. And just be mindful of that so that you can reach out and support other runners who might be in a place of struggle.
So, you know, if someone mentions something about, you know, maybe negative associated with running, or that they may be dealing with an issue, don't just dismiss it and laugh it off, you know.
Just dismiss it and say, oh, me too.
Right. Oh, that's normal. Ha, ha, ha. You know, just kind of maybe see if they want to dig into that a little bit and, you know, say, well, what do you mean, you know?
Right. It seems like you're going through a lot of stress lately. You know, how can I be supportive to you in this experience in your life?
So I want to turn the page a little bit and talk about eating disorders. Often we think about this as a problem only for young women. We kind of stereotype people and eating disorders, but that's not the case. So I would like to have you talk about the main eating disorders, maybe start with anorexia, and, you know, kind of the prevalence among runners, signs and symptoms, long-term consequences, all of that.
Sure. So I want to talk about, I think, problem eating behavior generally, because we get trapped a lot of times in this language where it's anorexia or it's bulimia or it's binge eating. But problem eating is more than that. So I would like to shift the dialogue, I think, always, and this is another one of my shift the dialogue to talk about problem eating generally. That problem eating is not good, right?
Right.
And so we have to be careful when we're talking about it with athletes, because athletes often exhibit signs and symptoms that don't meet criteria for an eating disorder and aren't actually problematic. And I'll use myself as an example in just a moment. So most athletes avoid certain foods. This is okay and totally normal. Most athletes feel a little fat sometimes. This is okay and totally normal. We want to be really concerned when eating behavior interferes with life and when eating behavior makes it difficult to engage in positive ways and other things in your life. So, for example, most athletes, myself included, avoid dairy because it isn't favorable for me when I add it with running. This is totally normal.
Right.
So I might not want to go with you to the ice cream parlor, but I don't allow that to interfere with my life. So I'll go with you to the ice cream parlor and I'll watch you enjoy your ice cream, but I'm not going to partake in it because that just isn't going to work for me from a dietary standpoint. All runners have things like this, where we have sensitivities to certain foods or we like to avoid certain types of things. This is totally normal. What we're looking for is a relationship with eating that interferes with life. So there are some classics. So anorexia, it's characterized by severe restriction of food. So self-starvation is generally considered part of anorexia. Usually for athletes, anorexia is accompanied by excessive exercise and punishment, usually in the form of more severe restriction. So weight loss is generally extreme and dramatic. And I say that because it's important, because to be a competitive runner, you often don't make it very far with anorexic behavior, because you have to eat in order to fuel your running. So what we'd be looking for is someone who restricts their food, exercises a great deal, and engages in punishment if they feel like they're exceeding some sort of magical calorie goal. So we do see anorexia sometimes with runners. We also see bulimia, which is a disorder that's characterized by purging behaviors, either with or without calorie restriction. So sometimes we think of bulimics as you eat a whole bunch of food and then purge. That's not necessarily true. Many people do experience anorexia and bulimia at the same time. So they'll restrict on one day and maybe consume a great deal of food another day or a normal amount of food another day and then purge, either through the use of laxatives and vomiting or purging through excessive exercise.
So maybe feeling like they have to earn their food through their exercise to keep that calorie level low or something?
Most of us have some sense around earning food. This is excessive punishment. Like, I'm a horrible person because I ate a cookie and now I need to run for a really long period of time. So something that's excessive and outside of the range of normal.
Okay.
This is also, both of these disorders or any type of disordered eating is usually accompanied by some element of body dysmorphia, which is an unrealistic or distorted view of one's body. So thinking that you're looking very fat when you're probably really not. Athletes are at extremely high risk for the development of disordered eating and eating disorders in particular. About 15% of female runners across the lifespan meet the criteria for anorexia.
Wow. That's really shocking.
Hmm.
About 20% of elite female road racers meet the criteria for disordered eating. And for athletes, often disordered eating is accompanied by exercise dependence. And so what we're looking for, again, isn't this normal and healthy relationship that many of us have with food, where we just occasionally avoid certain things because of digestive upset or something like that, or where we restrict in thoughtful ways preparing for an event or something like that.
Yeah, like, so some people who cut out, you know, sweets or wine or whatever, mm-hmm. you know.
When you're preparing for events, totally yes. normal. Mm-hmm. Totally okay. normal. Mm-hmm. It's also totally normal to get rid of a food group entirely because it causes digestive upset when you're running. What we're looking for is disordered eating that interferes with life, that makes it very difficult for you to engage in the activities that you used to find pleasurable or that you feel like you have to hide. We talk about that a lot with disordered eating. If you feel like you need to lie to someone or hide your eating behaviors from other people, it's not healthy.
Hmm. So is that because they feel like they're going to get a lot of shame from that person for what they choose to eat? Or is it often in a person's head?
It's in your head. And it's also, you know that what you're doing is not normal, right? People who struggle with disordered eating aren't out of touch with reality at all.
Right.
They really understand reality and understand that other people might think that this is problematic. And so if I'm going to engage in something that I think other people will judge, I'll try to hide that from those other people so that I can avoid that social stigma.
Right, right. So, you know, with body dysmorphic disorder, every runner probably has that one area of their body that is not their favorite, you know, the stomach, the thighs,
yes,
whatever.
Which is so normal.
So, you know, when does it, is it really categorized as a disorder? Where is that line, or is there one?
Mm-hmm. When it takes over your life. Right. This is the same as so many things. Is if it's having negative impact on your life and takes over your life, then that's probably problematic and would be something that we would consider unhealthy. I don't know many people who are in love with their body. Most people have sort of I guess it's my body relationship with their body or have particular problem areas. But for people who experience body dysmorphia, they see their body as grossly unrealistic compared to what the rest of us see it as. So you might say, I don't like my thighs. And I could say to you, I think your thighs look fine. And the rest of us would say, I think your thighs look fine.
Right.
And if you persist in that, in are sure of it, despite us trying to talk you out of it, we might start to be concerned.
Okay.
Right? Usually people can be persuaded. You say, I think your thighs are fine. You might say, oh, yeah, you're right. You know, I just am self-conscious about them.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's healthy and normal. So someone who experiences body dysmorphia, there's some classic studies about this where they ask women, it's generally women who experience body dysmorphia, to pick clothing that they think matches their body type or to draw pictures of their body. And someone who experiences body dysmorphia will select clothing that's gigantic compared to their actual body size. They'll draw pictures of their body, very grossly exaggerated round figures beyond what would be considered normal. So there are some classic studies of this where women suffering from anorexia who are basically skeletal drew pictures of themselves as round and fluffy and described themselves as such. And so this is really, really a lack of attention to the reality that the rest of us are experiencing.
So do you work with people on body acceptance?
Yeah, and generally, to be perfectly honest, if someone has gone in the direction of anxiety or bulimia, a full-on eating disorder, I would recommend specialty treatment at that point. Because any attempt to gain weight or to improve your relationship with food in the context of anorexia or bulimia should be monitored by a nutritionist or a dietitian, and at minimum, a medical doctor. So if we're talking about anorexia or bulimia, that should be in a specialty treatment environment.
Yeah, that's
where you
scary
get the
stuff.
Support. It's very scary because there's such a risk to the heart muscle when there's been a severe calorie restriction that death is a likely outcome. And so really specific treatment is necessary. What I see in practice is a lot more of the people who are experiencing disordered eating, a difficult relationship with food, where it's negatively impacted their life. And so what we see a lot in this case is an avoidance of all activities that include food, an avoidance of conversation around food or diet, excessive privacy around diet or hiding, weight gain or loss, excessive restriction or intake of food beyond what's reasonable. And this is always sticky with athletes because athletes are really weird about what they eat. But I say that there's this general test. If you go to an event that has food with 10 people and 9 of the 10 people think that what one person is doing is really weird, it's probably really weird.
Yeah.
If anyone says, yeah, me too, that makes sense, you're probably okay. That makes sense. Yeah. So, you know, disordered eating is something that impacts a lot of us where we engage in what's called in the field as compensatory behaviors, which is that earning your food or other forms of self-harm. And that's a difficult thing to talk about because it's hard to know where the line is, that normal compensatory behavior of I like the way I look and I'd like to stay fit versus I'm punishing myself for having consumed something that I wouldn't normally consume. So again, what we're really looking for is it impact your life in really negative ways?
Right. So yeah, it's definitely hard to have that healthy balance and relationship with food. I think, you know, even our online culture really feeds into this, and you know, even the running community, because I look on my Facebook feed, like just this morning, there was just articles about how to lose weight, because we know that, you know, up to some point, losing some weight can make you faster.
Make you faster.
And so we're bombarded with this, you know, is this new diet for runners good? Or lose weight in 5 easy steps. But that can be probably really triggering for a lot of people.
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. So, and I think we really struggle as a culture with disordered eating. I think this is a cultural artifact that is a culture we don't know what to eat or when to eat it or how to eat. And there's so much language around food that it can be really overwhelming and it can be really triggering for someone who already struggles with eating. And so I think that's another thing where we have an obligation as runners and as supportive people in the community to create a healthy food environment and to talk about food and talk about it really honestly. I mean, this type of conversation that we're having where I can say to you, I don't eat dairy because it causes some digestive problems right. is the type of conversation we need to be having as a community of runners to really just be more honest about what we're eating and why and how we choose to make those decisions so that we can self-monitor, so that we can create a culture around what's normal, and so that we can just reduce the stigma.
So if you feel like you have to hide some aspect of your eating, then that's, you know, probably kind of marching toward disordered eating.
Yes. If you feel like you have to hide it, if it's impacting your life in really negative ways, you probably are marching toward disordered eating. And that's something that you would want to take a look at and enlist the help of your trusted family and friends and training partners to monitor and really consider carefully.
So if a person, you know, recognizes these issues maybe in themselves or someone they really care about, you know, what resources can they go towards?
Great. There are lots of wonderful resources for eating disorders, and we can add those in your links. But what I always tell people is there's some great research in this area around people who survived really severe eating disorders. And on average, they are approached about seeking help around 15 times before they eventually seek help. So know that this is a long-term battle. And a lot of disordered eating is triggered by control. And so attempts to intervene are seen as loss of control. So attempts to intervene are not usually successful. And I don't mean to be discouraging about this. I mean to be realistic that the attempts really are generally unsuccessful, and that's okay. So know that if it's really a problem, that someone else has tried. Someone else has tried to talk to them. Expect some hesitation and resistance. Avoid accusations. And focus your concern on the athlete, not on weight, not on food, not on exercise, but on things like happiness, balance, health, right? It's not useful to say you're getting too skinny. That's just not a useful comment. But focusing on something like, you know, you just seem less happy, or things seem a little out of balance for you and I'm concerned about you. Those are the types of conversations that can help, because what you want to do is open the conversation.
Not make people defensive, right?
Exactly, exactly. And you're thinking about being non-threatening and opening the conversation, because also you could be wrong, right? They could really be engaged in something healthy and practical. And so you want to be really careful. I would say, too, it can be helpful to enlist some help. Of course, avoid ganging up on the person that you would like to talk to, but enlist some help. If there's another training partner or maybe a family or friend, to approach them and say something along the lines of happiness, health, balance.
Energy levels, whatever.
Right. We're all concerned about Sarah because she just doesn't seem very happy. She doesn't seem like herself. So the concern is really oriented towards health and happiness. And I always say consider other ways of approaching the situation, writing a letter, doing it via text message or email or phone call or something that might be less threatening. And then make a decision about what you're going to do if this individual ignores your concerns. How bad is it? You know, how much do you want to be a party to seeing someone hurt themselves? I think what we can all do is to create a healthy food environment. So when we hold running events, we're always really mindful to hold events at places where healthy food options are available. And something we do as a running club is we share the menu in advance. So we say, here's the run. It's happening at this place for brunch. Here's the menu. And we give the menu in advance so that people can make healthy decisions, whether this is just because they're avoiding something in a training cycle, because they have a health concern or an allergy, or so that they can make decisions that are healthy for themselves. We coordinate events that have food and others that do not. That's really important. So if you find that you're always having events that revolve around food, that might be triggering for someone who struggled with disordered eating.
Or isolating too, because they're isolating not because even going to go there.
Because then they won't go and they don't want to participate in the social aspect. I really think it's very important, and this is something I'm passionate about in terms of creating a healthy food environment, is don't tolerate negative comments about food or weight at group events. Don't food shame someone by pointing out what they're eating, and don't pressure someone to partake or not partake. We're very judgy and involved with other people's food choices. That's generally not healthy. So I really, at any event that I'm at, I don't tolerate these negative commentary about food or weight. I don't like to hear people talking about themselves in really negative ways. Right? It's one thing to talk about, you know, my thighs or something I'm a little concerned about. You know, I've been doing some weightlifting to try and improve versus something more negative.
Yeah, I think that's really excellent, looking at the conversations that are surrounding weight, food, things like that, because I can think back, you know, to my experience where it's been uncomfortable, whether something someone else said about their body, where you feel like you have to like jump in and reassure them that it's okay, or, you know, how it becomes like, well, if they think they're fat, then, you know, look at me kind of thing.
Exactly. And that creates a really healthy environment, because I think we're generally well-adjusted people, but if this is something you're struggling with, either in recovery or in an active phase, that can be really scary and really threatening. And I've worked with a number of athletes in recovery from eating disorders who have said that they really avoid group runs and they avoid going on these run brunches or pub runs or things like that because they're really concerned that someone's going to pressure them to eat something. And so that's a real concern. And they think about having to come up with lies to protect themselves. That's, to me, that's unhealthy as a culture. As a running community, I think we have an obligation to create a healthy food environment where we support people in their dietary choices, whatever they are.
So before we let you go, you have any races on the calendar coming up?
I do, actually. I do some pacing with marathonpacing.com. You see them in a lot of major events. And so usually in the fall, I don't run a marathon for myself. I pace. So I actually have 5 marathons coming up.
Wow, excellent.
That I'm going to be pacing in the New England East Coast area. So this is a great season for me because I get to marathon train, but with no pressure for time, which is amazing. It is someone who really loves the process of running. This is my favorite time of year because I'm running all of my runs at a leisure pace.
Nice.
And it's fantastic.
And helping people accomplish their goals is, you know, so fulfilling.
It's so fulfilling. And it's just an amazing time. And it's an amazing time in New England when our leaves start to change. So it's a really beautiful time to be running and to be running with other people.
What were some of the marathons you're going to be at?
I am going to be at Mohawk Hudson, which is in Albany, New York. I will be at, I'm thinking, really testing my recall now. I'll be at Atlantic City Marathon. That's a great one. A lot of it's nice. On the boardwalk. Really beautiful. Highly recommend. I'll be at the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Marathon. That's another really great one.
I just did the Harrisburg half on Sunday.
I did the Harrisburg half on Sunday too.
Oh,
that's
my goodness.
Crazy. That's hilarious. I paced.
This is
it.
Always happening to me. We have guests on the podcast, and we were at the same race, and we didn't even know.
Yeah, I paced 2:30.
Well, that's so awesome.
Okay, all right. Do you remember the guy wearing Speedos? He was the 2-hour pacer.
Yes, I know him.
I was with that guy.
That outfit. I love him.
That guy was a mess. He was a hot mess.
He is a hot mess. But you know what? You just want to follow him. Like, he makes an amazing pacer because you're like, I don't know what to do in this situation. Like, I just am so intrigued by your eccentric nature.
He liked to encourage and trash talk. So, like, I remember running with him, and I think we saw the 2:30 on the out and back part. And
that's me!
Yeah, and he says, go 2 hours better than 2.5.
Woo-hoo. Oh, I remember when he said that. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. We actually got such a good laugh out of that.
Okay. Wow, what a small world. You know what? I actually didn't make it quite at 2. I made it at 2:01. So I was hoping I would never see that guy again. But I went to a social gathering for the River Runners Club and sat right next to him at brunch. Thankfully, he had his pants on.
So. I'm glad he had his pants on for that. That's cool. I asked him, I was like, how much body glide do you have on? Are you like a human slip and slide over there? Because I would have to cover myself in body glide.
He is maybe blessed with tough skin or something.
Well, let me ask you, as a pacer, what's the sweet spot for you? What do you typically pace?
I'll pace anything in a half marathon, 2 hours and slower. But my sweet spot is really like 2:30. That's a great thing. I really, really love 2:40 in a half marathon because 2:40 is exactly 12-minute miles. And so it's easy math. But I really love that. I love pacing people who are doing a major event for the first time or who are working on a really major life goal. So I meet a lot of really cool people who are just thrilled and it's their first marathon or their first half marathon. And I love that. And that's also a pace where we can like have a snack and talk and hang out.
Yeah. And get mocked by the 2-hour group.
We have so much fun. So I'm a party in the back girl. That's my thing is right the parties in the back.
Oh yeah.
I should have been back in your group then.
Oh yeah. I mean, we were fun back there, like telling jokes and stuff. I love that though. I think I always think of 5 hours as a really big marathon goal for, you know, 5 hours is a big goal. 4 hours is a big goal. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of people just percentage wise looking at the statistics won't achieve 4 hours. 5 hours is a really manageable goal for the vast majority of people. And so I love pacing 5 hours because 5 hours, you get such a wide variety. You get younger people who it's their first marathon. You get older people doing the bucket list thing. You get people who have done lots of marathons and really want that like 4:59 break 5-hour goal. So yes. I love 5 hours is actually my favorite time to pace because of the diversity of the group that you get.
When one signs up to be a pacer, is there like a race time that you are required? Like how far under your pace had you have had to run?
Yep, there is. The company that I pace with has some pretty strict standards around that. So we do usually 20 minutes to a half an hour for a marathon and about 15 minutes for a half marathon. But we're also really experienced. I mean, on average, most of us have run more than 50 marathons. And I would say that a lot of us have run more than 100. And so we have tons of experience that we're bringing to it and are really dedicated and comfortable with the marathon experience.
Awesome. Nice. It's been awesome to pick your brain and really talk about these important issues. And I think, you know, it's really going to help a lot of people change the conversation around the issue of addiction and, you know, eating disorders as well.
Good. I hope so. I really think, you know, if everyone listening to this could just take away one thing, which is we all have an opportunity to be a positive example of our relationships with food and exercise, do that. We're creating a healthier world, not just for our training partners, but for everyone who sees that.
Right on.
Well, have a great afternoon. Thanks for talking to us.
All right. Thanks for having me. This is so exciting.
Yeah, maybe we'll run into you at a race one of these days.
I'll be at Harrisburg Marathon.
All right.
I'm pacing 5 hours.
I might spectate that.
Well, wave frantically at me when I run by.
Yes.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
See you later.
Bye.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rachel. And folks, if something that she talked about really resonated with you, make sure you do reach out. I'm sure she would be happy to get an email from some of you. And if you feel like you need to reach out to some friends or family, you know, to talk about an issue that you're struggling with, please don't hesitate to do that. And if there's any way that we can support you, just let us know.
That's right.
Well, before we get into this episode's quick tip, we'd like to thank our fabulous podcast sponsors. First of all, big thanks to RX Bar. They make a whole food protein bar with a few simple, clean ingredients that all serve a purpose. Egg whites for protein, dates to bind, and nuts for texture. And their motto is full transparency and no BS. In fact, it says no BS right on the packaging, which makes me want to eat it even more.
That's right. They actually list all their core ingredients right on the package in big letters, so there's nothing hidden. These RX bars are really perfect for breakfast on the go. If you need a snack during the day to throw in your bag for, you know, after a run, a hike, traveling, anytime.
They come in 11 flavor varieties, all of which are gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, and free of added sugar, artificial colors, preservatives, and fillers.
Yeah, so whether you like a sweet or savory taste, chocolate or fruit flavors, there is an RX bar for you.
So definitely check them out, folks. We love them. It's called RX Bar. You can find them at rxbar.com. And you can get 25% off your first order with our special promo code. Just go to rxbar.com/MTA. Use the code MTA at checkout for 25% off. That's rxbar.com/MTA. We also like to thank Health IQ for sponsoring this episode. They've been a great partner of the MTA podcast.
Health IQ believes that marathoners are unsung heroes, and they've spent the last few years partnering to get lower rates on life insurance using science and data. They believe the best way to improve the health of the world is to celebrate the health conscious, rather than harass and cajole those who are not.
Because what the data shows is that people that run marathons have a 29% lower risk of mortality, a 50% lower risk of heart disease, which should qualify you for a better life insurance rate because you're a good insurance risk. So Health IQ has come along, they've taken the data, and they've negotiated with A-plus insurance carriers to get you a life insurance rate that reflects the health-conscious lifestyle that you live.
That's right. Unlike other insurance carriers, they can cater to runners with things like slow resting heart rates. They measure triglyceride HDL cholesterol ratio in addition to the HDL ratio for people like low carb dieters. They measure waist to hip ratio in addition to body mass index for those with muscular builds.
So head over to healthiq.com/MTA to get a free rate quote and take one of their quizzes. We actually helped them create the marathon quiz. So see what they can do for you. That's healthiq.com/MTA. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And we got a great question that recently came across maybe, I don't know, Facebook or somewhere about what to do if a long run goes bad before one's marathon or half marathon. Should you redo the long run? Should you panic? I mean, this is actually a question we've gotten quite a few times.
Yeah, the question comes from Jonathan. He says, I really enjoyed your podcast the last 2 years, and you and Trevor have motivated me along the way. I'm training for my third marathon at the Leavenworth, Washington Marathon. For my last run, it was super smoky, and I tried to run with a mask on. I ended up running about 19 miles, which was less than my training plan called for. Now I'm supposed to taper down till the September 28th race day. I have all these thoughts going on in my head that I won't be able to run the entire marathon since my last long run was less than ideal. Should I still taper or do another long run tomorrow since the smoke is gone? So just coming back from out west, I know how bad the fires have been and the smoke for many, many runners. And, you know, I'm sure that's put a definite hitch in some people's training plans this summer.
Not only that, but we've had, you know, lots of folks affected by hurricanes.
Yeah, it's just been a terrible weather summer. And
that'll screw up your whole weekend, right?
Well, if you have flooding in your house, that's going to do a lot more long-term damage as well. So yeah, a lot of people who are going through some serious weather-related issues. And this is a question, like you said, Trevor, that we often hear from runners who have had less than ideal final long runs due to things like weather conditions, illness, fueling problems, you know, a number of different reasons. And it can be really tempting to want to skip a part of the taper and try to cram in more training. But, you know, since Jonathan was able to run 19 miles under less than ideal conditions, then I really think he needs to be confident that he has what it takes to successfully run the marathon. It's more a matter of mental confidence at this point in his training, and this is something that almost all marathoners struggle with at some point, whether they have perfect long runs or, you know, a big bump in the road.
Yeah.
So my advice to almost anyone who's had a crappy final long run would be to proceed with the taper and not try to cram in another long run, which can actually hurt you more in the long term. Now, there are rare cases of very experienced marathoners, or maybe someone who was unable to complete even half of the distance they were supposed to go. And in that case, it might be better to make it up 3 to 5 days later and then proceed on with your tapering. But for the majority of people, stick with your taper, and for those last couple of weeks, work on developing some strong mantras. Because if your mind will keep you on track, then your body can definitely go the distance. So a good goal would be to arrive at the starting line feeling healthy and well-rested, and to really keep in mind that you do have what it takes to run strong and to meet your marathon goal.
I think sometimes people don't view the tapering period as important as it really is, you know?
Yeah, it's like, you know, you spent all this time challenging, pushing yourself, and sometimes we get confidence by doing those really hard things. And then it feels like, oh, well, this easier section here, I mean, that can't be good for me. I mean, how is my fitness going to continue building?
Or worse, I will start sliding backwards in my fitness during this rest period.
And during the taper, a lot of people often deal with, you know, all this mental turmoil, and sometimes even physical aches and pains will crop up. And so that can really shoot down your confidence. But if you realize that's normal, it's part of the process, and the taper is really designed to help you perform your very best on race day. And if you don't have an effective taper, then you're probably going to go into the race fatigued, with less power physically and mentally, and, you know, less than ideal outcome.
You know, tapering is so important, and there is a lot of anxiety around it and misunderstanding. We actually have a whole lesson in the academy for members about tapering before a race. I think you refer to it as the dreaded taper.
For many people, it can feel dreaded. For some people, it comes as a relief. But yeah, the whole gist of this lesson is how people can maximize this built-in rest period in your marathon training plan to help you have good results on race day.
So thank you so much for the question, Jonathan, and hopefully that helps a lot of you out there who have had this issue or had this question. Thank you, Coach Angie, for being the voice of sanity.
That's right. Good luck, Jonathan, on your upcoming marathon. And he said that the medals have been bottle openers in past years.
Yeah.
And apparently it kind of coincides with like an Oktoberfest in the area. So yeah.
Leavenworth, Washington was designed to look like a German Bavarian village, I think.
Yeah, so that sounds like one that you should put on your list, Trevor.
Speaking of German, I'm going to be running the Munich Marathon in a couple weeks. I'm definitely looking forward to being over there and running another marathon. This will be marathon number 14, and hopefully we will put together a nice race recap here on the podcast about the Munich Marathon. Try to get some sound bites, in fact, from the race. Not quite sure what I'm going to do yet, but it'll be epic, whatever it is.
Oh, please.
Well, we appreciate all of you. Thank you for being a listener. If you find value in this podcast, please share it with a running friend, a non-running friend. Well, probably a running friend would like it better.
And leave us a positive review on iTunes. That would be really appreciated.
And until next time, folks, keep taking action toward your goals. And remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way. Oh, wait.